This is the morning show here on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Pregnancy and new motherhood are portrayed in popular culture as a beautiful state of being where a woman's body is aglow, engaged in the act of creating, then nurturing a new soul. But many women have serious and painful issues during pregnancy, and many women experience postpartum issues too. And says Angela Garbus, many women are taken by surprise. Garbus is the author of Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy. Angela, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
I should note that you are joining us by Skype, and I also should note that we really want to hear from callers on this, especially mothers, especially if you have had a pregnancy that surprised you in much the same way it surprised Angela. The number is 800-642-1234. ideas@wpr.org is our email address, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Angela, when you first found out that you were pregnant, it was unexpected. You'd been drinking with your husband the night before. And the first question you had was, I was drinking when I got pregnant. Is that going to have a bad effect on the baby? What was the answer to that question?
Well, the answer to the question was unclear. So I immediately hung up the phone and I started Googling. And I mean, I should add that, you know, part of the reason why the pregnancy from the get-go was a surprise, because I had actually lost a pregnancy 2 months prior. So nothing in my life had returned to normal. There was a grieving process that was going on, still ongoing at the time. And I hadn't gotten my period yet. So really, pregnancy was not on my radar. So I got this phone call from my doctor telling me, you know, you're pregnant. And I was a little bit in shock. So I hung up the phone, and like most people, the first thing I did was I started Googling. You know, and I was actually hungover. So in my state, I was a little foggy headed. And Googling led me to the What to Expect website, which said, you know, you shouldn't have any alcohol when you're pregnant, because, you know, whatever you're taking in, the baby takes in as well, and it takes twice as long for the alcohol to leave the fetus. You know, at that point, I think actually it's just an embryo. It's so early. And so I thought, oh God, okay. So I've already started. This is not good, right?
And you just come off losing a child. You just come off losing a pregnancy. So there was that fear that was even more heightened.
Yes, and for a number of reasons. I mean, I was 36 when I had my first child, which is already considered, you know, advanced maternal age.
Yes.
Sometimes geriatric is a word that's used in the clinical sense. You know, so you know, when you have a miscarriage, you're wondering, even though miscarriage is very common, you know, 20 to 25% of diagnosed pregnancies will end in miscarriage. Mm-hmm. You really go through the gamut of emotions and feeling like, am I too old for this? You know, or is like, all those years that I was on birth control, like, did something happen, right? And it's not necessarily rational, but that's part of grief. That's part of loss.
Right.
So here I am. I'm in this state, and now I'm like, okay, so my cobweb-lined uterus may not be able to support a pregnancy, but here I am. I'm pregnant. Okay, again. And I've been drinking. Okay. So, you know, I read this sentence on What to Expect, and I'm like, okay, this is bad. And then literally the next sentence is, you know, but what about the night out with your girlfriends where you had a few too many margaritas? And I had been drinking tequila the night before. So I'm like, okay, this is me.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, you know, it happens to everyone. Don't worry about it.
Fetus could be harmed, but don't worry about it.
Right. And this is, you know, it's the same source. It's the same paragraph. And I felt that was a sign to me right away, you know, here is seemingly definitive information, and yet it feels really contradictory. And my brain immediately was like, what are the sources? Where is this coming from? Who's telling me this? And that's really, it was the first time, you know, that I had a moment in for the next 2 years, you know, these were questions that didn't have satisfying answers. And that's really how a lot of things in pregnancy and early motherhood went for me when I looked for information.
You know, one of the things that I found interesting in pregnancy is I would ask my doctor what medicines I would take, and she would be like, you can't take these. These other ones are in a class where we're not sure, so go ahead and take them.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I think, you know, a really great physician will tell you, we don't really know, right?
Right.
Or we can have, or would perhaps have a more nuanced discussion. And, you know, the way that we have the class C, class A, like there were these ways of classifying things from, you know, no known risk, like definitely don't have these. That system has actually changed. And now, you know, so, you know, that's, you're talking about over the counter stuff, but, you know, for women who take things like SSRIs or antidepressants, before the advice was, if you want to be pregnant, if you're even considering being pregnant, you should probably go off those meds. And, you know, that's 15 years ago that people are telling, but you're being told this. And meanwhile, that's also treating, you know, like it implies to women that having a mental illness is not a disease that can be managed, but that maybe, you know, you're flawed or maybe you're not fit for motherhood. That's sort of subtly implied in that. And now what we're seeing is more research has been done and we still don't have a lot of definitive answers, but it seems that especially with SSRIs that the risk is lower. And so now a lot of doctors understand that we have to be thinking about maternal health as well. If someone goes off of meds, how does that affect them? And how does that affect their ability to continue living a normal, healthy life and their ability to care for a child and ability to care for a fetus? And it's a lot more nuanced. And now doctors are able to have conversations with patients that are saying, you know, what level of risk are you comfortable with? And how will this affect your life if you change your medication?
There's a lot of judgment you write about in towards pregnant women, like whether to have a natural birth, whether to breastfeed or not. Women are judging each other, and society is judging women and their choices.
Yeah, you know, and I actually, it's very common to say, you know, you have natural childbirth or medicated childbirth, and I really have come to a place where I don't think that we should use the term, I'm using air quotes here, we can't see each other, but I'm using finger quotes, you know, natural childbirth, that's usually meant to describe vaginal childbirth. Mm-hmm. But I believe that a baby being born is natural, and whether that the baby comes out of your vagina or whether that baby is comes out of your uterus directly, those are both natural. And I think when we set it up that one is more natural than the other, a lot of women will feel like they're unnatural. A lot of women will feel that they have failed in some way. And I think from the get-go, that's really unfair. We don't set women up for success or to feel good in that sense. And the truth is that in this day and age, I mean, we can debate, is the C-section rate too high? Are there unnecessary C-sections? But C-sections also developed as a way of, they do save lives. Mm-hmm. And my own experience is I had two C-sections and I'm grateful for both of them. And, you know, we give birth two ways now. That's just how it is. And so I think it'd be better to reframe that conversation that way.
How did you do with your C-section? Postpartum, how did you do with that?
Well, I'm still, you know, actually I have a three-month-old who we may hear from.
Okay.
We may have a Kelvin Roy situation at any point because I'm in New York right now. I live in Seattle, but I'm in New York. I've been here for events and for press and... So her schedule's a little off and she may be stirring and she may need to eat, just FYI. But my C-sections were, you know, C-section is major abdominal surgery.
It is.
And anyone who's been through that knows that. But I, you know, I was actually born via C-section, but I did not have a true understanding of all that was involved in that. And because with my first pregnancy, I intended to have an intervention-free, unmedicated vaginal birth, and that's just not what happened at all. I ended up being induced, I had an epidural, and then I had basically a near-emergency C-section. And I was completely unprepared. You know, I didn't know, even too, that, you know, it's not like they just cut you open. They cut open your skin, they move fat, they move your abdominal muscles out of the way, they're cutting through peritoneum, which encases everything, they're cutting through fascia, which, you know, binds ligaments to bone and that, all of that. And then they're moving your bladder out of the way. They're moving your bowels. And this, you know, all that stuff has to go back in. Never mind, they're also then coming through your uterus, right? So there's multiple layers of scarring. There's multiple layers of stitching that happens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a recovery from a C-section is, you really can't do anything for at least 2 weeks.
And you have a newborn.
Yeah. So recovering from surgery is very much at odds with the basic requirements of caring for a newborn. And I'm glad that some people will go into that with eyes more open than I did, but I I felt really unprepared. So, you know, mentally and emotionally, that was challenging, but also just physically. It was really a month before I could go on a walk, which was my daily form of exercise. And I felt really weak for a long time. And I had pain that wasn't related to my incision specifically, but pain. And many women sustain pelvic floor injuries and pelvic injuries that we don't really talk about.
We are going to talk about that in a moment. We're talking about pregnancy myths and what really happens to your body when you give birth. And we're taking your calls. We've got one call we're going to get to after the break. 1-800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. I love this music. We love to idealize pregnancy and those first few days and weeks of parenthood, but honestly, it's hard work and often painful. We're talking about the myths of giving birth and why we seem to have no common wisdom to pass down to women. Angela Garbus's first pregnancy led her to write Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy. She joins us right now by Skype. Angela, there's a caller here. I think is the caller ready? The caller has Delma from Milwaukee.
Yes.
I've been reading what they've been typing as they're having a conversation with you, Delma. And this is a very interesting story you have. Talk to us.
Yes. I'm a runner. I was a runner back then a lot more. I've run maybe many, many marathons in my lifetime.
Good for you.
My husband and I was never trying to get pregnant. We were just living life. But at the age of 34, not realizing I was pregnant for 6 months, never knew I was pregnant. We just never knew. I kept running. I kept drinking occasionally, nothing over extremely. But I was at work one day, and I had to restrain one of my kids at school and found myself to be a little more tired and sweaty and a little fatigued. So that day I got back from work and I told my husband, I said, hey, I feel kind of weak. What's going on? So we went to the doctor, got the chest and drew some blood. And 3 days later they came and they called me and they said to go by to the hospital and find out what was going on. Come to find out that we were pregnant for 6 months already.
Wow.
Yes. And how could I not know that? I have absolutely no idea. The baby was stretched out from the legs, from one rib, from one side of the hip to the, and then the head on the other side of the hip. Because I wasn't big at all. I mean, I wasn't, I never had any sickness, never had any symptoms. I didn't, obviously never knew because that was our first baby.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and even when I found out that I was drinking throughout the 6 months, it never worried me because I never knew about it. Mentally, it was and not intentionally. I just sometimes wonder, some people, it is good to go on Google and find out if you're, what are the symptoms, what happens if all this happens.
Right.
There was no Google back then when I had my son, but sometimes it's a little strain on the body and on the mental mentality of a person that if you do go check everything on Google, it'll stress your body out a little more.
Google thinks everything is cancer. I have a headache. It's cancer. I can't, you know, there's something in my eye. It's cancer. So let's stay off the Google machine. But I'm wondering, your son is fine, right?
Oh, my God. My son's an engineer at the...
There you go.
Good work, Delma.
It turned out to be that I have three great runners. My daughter is a runner in Illinois State. And I was pregnant with her for 4 months before finding out that I was pregnant.
Wow.
I mean, we didn't know. My husband and I were like, what's going on? Why can't I know? And all of a sudden, our third child, I said, I have to, you know, we have to go check a little bit more. But the, our third child, we did know that I was pregnant after 2 months, 3 months or something like that. But, yeah, it turned out to be a good thing.
Good. Well,
The Google machine, you know, that I think it's an important reminder that it's really, it's so a part of our life. It's so ubiquitous now, but it's pretty recent, you know, I mean, the last decade that mm-hmm. this has become that, you know, the anxiety and the sort of constant state of panic or immediately summarized, like summoned state of panic that happens when you're pregnant is new. For centuries, you know, women were fine, right? It's an event in your life and you figured out how to handle that. And, I just think that that's a really good reminder that it's very new that we do this right. And we kind of induce these states in ourselves.
Angela, you know, for centuries, women had other women. Women had their mothers and their grandmothers and their aunts and their cousins, and they all lived in the same place or in the same proximity. It's really only in the last generation or two that we've split apart and your mother lives across the country from you and cannot just kind of look at you one day, walk in and look at you and go, you're pregnant. And you're like, no, I'm not pregnant. I'm not pregnant at all. And she's like, yes, you are. Let's go.
Yeah, there's not a woman nearby who can, you know, assess your energy or just smell it, right? Women who have that intuition and knowledge. And I think that, again, it's good to point out that it's really been in the last century that we've moved away from that. You know, it was midwives who were not necessarily formally trained, but who had generations of knowledge and wisdom that were passed down and lived experience. They were the people who guided childbirth. And, you know, the practice of midwifery is seeing that pregnancy and motherhood are natural, normal events in a woman's life. You know, they're significant and life-changing, but they're not conditions, right? Or illnesses, right? Mm-hmm. And at the turn of the 20th century, it's worth talking about how in America, there was a very specific effort to discredit midwives and to establish and legitimize the emerging field of obstetrics and gynecology. And that was very specifically in institutions and medical schools, which were the territory of really privileged and financially well-off white men. It was a very deliberate movement. And, you know, it's important to know that history. And I think, again, I'm also interested in where are we at now, right? So I think that people have pushed back against this medicalization of childbirth. And now we tend to divide into these two camps, as we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier, medical and natural. And I think both sides, you know, can sort of learn from each other because we have directly benefited from advances in medicine and technology, but there's much wisdom and much to learn from traditional practices in pregnancy and childbirth. And my hope is that these two camps, instead of being adversaries, can refocus on women, on mothers. And at this point, you can choose how you want to give birth. And why don't we just make sure that however you want to give birth, that method is safe and accessible.
And insured. Because that sometimes insurance has to do with it. You have to go to a hospital under some insurances. You cannot have your baby at home with a midwife.
Right. That's true. That's true. And that's a whole other ball of wax. You know, I mean, a year ago when I was working on this book, we were seriously debating whether or not we were going to even cover, you know, we were talking about repealing the ACA and not even guaranteeing prenatal coverage and maternity care under individual plans. And that's, you know, that's a very dark place and a very shameful place to be at as a nation. And, you know, and part of that was also talking about significant cuts to Medicaid. And, you know, 4 million people give birth in the United States and 2 million of those people receive coverage under Medicaid.
Indeed.
So we were debating whether or not half the people in the United States deserved the most basic care. So
that is an excellent point. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're getting a few calls in right now. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Katie from Delafield. Katie, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Katie.
So thank you for having this conversation. Secondly, I just want to mention that after my first child, I had a vaginal birth, and my friends would always say, oh, did you try without the epidural? Which, first of all, that just made me mad.
Because, yes.
Yes, mm-hmm. But at the same time, why? Just to say that is just irritating. Yeah, I did, but I wanted the epidural, so whatever. Yeah. It was great. Secondly, I just wanted to mention real quick something that no one ever told me, not my doctor, not my nurses, no one, none of my friends that had kids, is the pain level after a vaginal birth for your first is just ridiculously high. And I like to think I have a high pain tolerance, but, you know, I had the epidural, had the baby, and I was fine until I got home. And then I was like, oh my gosh, getting up to get a glass of water or getting up to feed the baby, mm-hmm. moving is difficult. And something that somebody mentioned to me is they were like, oh, here, make an ice diaper, which I had never heard of. It was in mm-hmm. none of the books. And I was like, what? And they're like, literally put ice in a baby's diaper and you put it in your underwear. And I was like, this is amazing. I feel like women should be able to talk to each other about things like that. And so thank you for the conversation.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely felt that. I mean, there have been books, you know, like, I was talking to someone who mentioned The Girlfriend's Guide to Pregnancy, which came out, you know, over a decade ago, how the best advice I was given definitely did not come from a doctor or a book. It came from people who had just experienced this. And, you know, now I think I had read about how in preparing for my vaginal, what I thought would be my vaginal birth,
right.
that people said you should get a diaper and pour witch hazel into it and then put it in the freezer and sort of a gift to your postpartum self. And so I'm hoping, you know, more women are sharing this information and people go into things a little more prepared, because it's not good. It's wrong. In fact, you know, Katie would go through this and come out of it and say, why didn't anyone tell me this? No one told me this. How could I not know? Hundreds of thousands of people do this every day around the world. Right. Why don't we know about this?
Why isn't there an internet thing for women? You know, things to do, common wisdom, things to do to help you with this issue postpartum or this issue when you're pregnant, just kind of like a wisdom for women.
I think that, I mean, this information does exist out there, but there's really it's a black hole where your attention span and sanity goes to die. It's these online forums, right? Where there's a lot of, it's hard to go through, you know, like to spend time going through all these different topics. It can be really frustrating in that way.
I think Katie wanted to say something.
Yeah.
Kate. Oh, nope. She just left us. Okay, fine.
Hello.
Katie from Janesville. Oh, we were going to go back to the other caller, but Katie, welcome to the program.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for handling my call. My main comment was you just got to roll with it. I've had four kids. The first one came early, because he shut off my kidney, and I had to have surgery to be able to get the kidney to work, and then that brought on premature labor. The next one came perfectly naturally. The next one, I had to go into a whirlpool, and my fourth one, she flipped and went transverse, and I had emergency C-section.
Hmm. Yeah.
I had them at 36, 38, 40, and 43.
Wow.
You've had the full experience.
The biggest thing that I learned through it all is that each one of them is very different.
Yeah.
And you have to roll with it. You have to be in the moment and trust your gut. The books, the doctors, they help, but you really, really have to trust your gut. There's instinct there if you let it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think it's really important to hear that. Everybody, please listen to Katie. I think that's true. You know, when it comes to pregnancy is so fraught. It's so complicated that, you know, I understand the desire to get easy answers, right? But a lot of books tend to prescribe things like this is the right way to do thing. This is a better way to do thing. And I'm not sure that framework really works. It is what matters is being able to roll with it and understanding that there's only so much that you can control. And as she was saying, too, in terms of trusting yourself, you know, doctors have training and there's a level of expertise that they bring to things. But when it comes to your own body and your own lived experience, you are also an expert.
I'm told, Angela, that you went to a physical therapist after giving birth to your second child. And you found out that some of the exercises that you were given to help you recover from the first birth actually made things worse.
Well, so yes. Yeah, so I act, it's It's interesting. I literally wrote a book about this stuff. I had chronic pain.
That's
after chronic hip pain after my first pregnancy. And I had my, because the standard of care is 1 6-week appointment for women who have given birth.
Right.
Meanwhile, babies get a 1 week, a 1 month, a 2 month, a 6 month, a 9 month, and a 1 year checkup. So just by comparing, that tells you, you know, where our emphasis is and who we value. We value the baby's health over the mother's health. So I had gone to my appointment, but, you know, nothing had really been addressed and I was having this pain. So I started going to a dance class, which really helped me and made me feel strong in my body again. And I thought was really helping me. So fast forward to 3 years later, I've written this book. I interviewed a physical therapist, but I never went and got postpartum physical therapy for myself. Mm-hmm. But after this last birth, just back in March, I went and had a physical therapy appointment. And she, you know, physical therapy, I really think that every woman who gives birth should have this, even if it's just one appointment, even if you never go back again. Someone will go in and look at your body. And, you know, childbirth, however it happens, involves muscles and fascia and ligaments. And that's what physical therapy deals with. And you can get an assessment of where your body's at, and you can leave with what is essentially a prescription just for you to work on these muscles. And so I found out that, you know, all of these deep stretches that I had been doing in dance that made me feel really good may actually be exacerbating the issue that I have. Mm. And so now I'm working to strengthen other muscles and counter that out. And I never would have known if I hadn't gone to physical therapy. And now I'm thinking about my body in a totally different way. And it feels really good. And it's helping.
1-800-642-1234 is the number. Tell us about your pregnancy. Tell us about whether you had pain, whether it was a totally normal pregnancy. And it was idyllic with flowers growing out of your baby's hair.
Yes, are you,
isn't it? Are you pregnant? Did you receive unsolicited advice or judgment? 1-800-642-1234. I'm wondering, Angela, very quickly before we had to break, when you talk to doctors, what do they say about why they don't focus on the woman postpartum? Why they focus on the baby so much? And there's nothing really there for how women can physically heal.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, to be honest, this is probably my own personal failing. I mean, I haven't really had those explicit conversations with people, because it's very hard to, I mean, with my own doctor who I love, but it's hard to you feel like you're confronting them with this. Mm. Right. And I think it's really, you find that you have to advocate for yourself. Most doctors, I like to assume good intent. I don't think that they're trying to diminish your importance.
I think they're just taught that.
It's just the way that they're trained,
right,
is to really focus on the baby's health. Here's this new, very vulnerable, fresh person. But I think it's just missing from the conversation that, you know, when you give birth, there's really two new people, right? There's a baby and there's also a mother. And you grow and you change along with your young. And we just... that understanding of motherhood is sorely lacking in our culture.
Did you breastfeed?
I did breastfeed, and I am currently breastfeeding now.
Oh, that's right. And there she is. Is that your baby that we just heard in the background?
No, that was a siren going by.
Oh, you're in New York, of course. It's when you breastfeed, you actually thought it would save you time. I want you to talk a little bit about this for about 30 seconds. And then actually, we're going to go to a break right now and come back and talk about breastfeeding. You are listening to The Morning Show. We are talking about pregnancy and the myths of pregnancy, things that women don't know when they give birth and after they give birth. I'm Carrie Kaufman. This is The Morning Show. Yeah. It's the morning show. We're talking to writer Angela Garbus about what women don't know about pregnancy. And we're going to take more of your calls. 1-800-642-1234. Tell us about your pregnancy. Tell us what surprised you about your first pregnancy. What wisdom would you like to pass on to other women who are finding themselves pregnant for the first time? 1-800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Morning. So, Angela, we left before that last break talking about breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. You breastfed both your children, and you are breastfeeding right now. Maybe not this instant, but you're newborn.
It's not at this exact moment, but definitely my body is sort of a ticking clock.
And I totally understand that. So talk to me about what you thought breastfeeding was. What it was supposed to be, what society, what culture tells us breastfeeding is supposed to be, and what it is for you.
Right. So, I mean, I think women face tremendous pressure to breastfeed, and we're told, I mean, the frame is that breast is best. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of left at that, and the implication being, you know, that formula is worse, right, or bad.
Right.
And, you know, I think that breastfeeding is great. I mean, we are mammals, so that's our most distinguishing characteristic is that we have mammary glands and we've evolved to be able to feed our babies with milk that we produce from our bodies. So that's great. You know, I wanted to do that. I felt like that's what my body was built to do. You know, missing from the conversation is that not everyone is going to be able to do that. Right. For physical reasons, like sometimes the body is just not cooperative. And also the fact is that 25% of American women go back to work 2 weeks after giving birth. So breastfeeding, in that sense, is oftentimes just impossible to do because it is very much a full-time job.
Right.
You can spend, very close to 8 hours a day breastfeeding. A newborn needs to eat about every 2 hours. And that clock starts when you start breastfeeding, not when the baby finishes eating. So sometimes it feels like you're doing it, sometimes it feels like you're doing it all the time.
Right.
So for a number of reasons that I just talked about, I wanted to breastfeed, and I went into it thinking like, it's free. The only thing that's required is my body. And that I look back and I think that was very naive because it's built into this idea. We expect women to do it. It's biologically, it's built into us. But it's really only free if we don't value women's time. Oh. Or in our culture, we're a capitalist society that depends on domestic work that we really just don't talk about. It's domestic work that's overwhelmingly done by women, and it includes feeding children and breastfeeding. But, there's lost wages that come into that equation, and also just that, again, this is valuable life-sustaining work, but we don't think of it that way. We think of it as being free, and we take it for granted. And when I went back to an office, I was still nursing when I was home with my baby, but I went to an office and I was pumping.
Mm-hmm.
And that's two or three times a day. And that's, a half an hour each time. And, those things are protected and still are, thankfully, under the ACA. You're allowed to have time and a space that's not a bathroom to go pump milk.
Right.
But again, a lot of times people are doing this while working, and we don't factor in that takes time away from you.
And you can't really pump in the middle of a meeting.
It's wages.
You can't multitask there. Yeah.
I mean, you could, and I hope it really in a very progressive work office, perhaps you could, but not all people feel comfortable with that. And certainly, most likely in your meeting, there are going to be many people who are not comfortable with that.
Right. Looking at this from a medical science perspective, there's a lot we don't know, even basic information about female anatomy and biology. For example, doctors still don't know what triggers labor?
Yeah, no, we don't know.
Wow.
it's really wild. That's why, you wait and due dates come and go, and sometimes you go into labor early. The more research I've done, there is a part of me that thinks maybe we'll never know, and maybe we shouldn't, because it's really, I think it was one of the earlier callers, Katie, who said, you just got to roll with it. It's birth is one of the universe's great mysteries, right? Like there's, even if you are so prepared, it may not go exactly how it's planned. But yeah, I think we don't know, and we have far less of a clue also because we've never really valued studying it. We just, again, take it for granted that it's going to happen, and we're just going to keep having people. And yeah, I was shocked when I learned that. We don't know.
And looking this, another example of this is lack of information. You talked about alcohol. You were drinking the night before you found out you were pregnant, and the caller earlier today was drinking for 6 months before she realized she was pregnant. Everything was fine, and yet we know there's something called fetal alcohol syndrome. Do we know what causes it, and why sometimes it turns out fine and why not?
You know, we don't. That's the thing, and that's why it's hard to have these conversations because they're, or we don't have them, I think, because they're complicated and they require nuance. I don't actually think it's that hard to have them once you engage with them. But, you know, fetal alcohol syndrome is this, I'm gesturing as though there's a dark cloud above me right now. And, you know, that's what's really lorded over women. Don't drink any alcohol because your baby could develop FAS. But in researching, what I discovered was that fetal alcohol syndrome was, it was invented in 1971. I mean, it's based in research, but it was researchers at the University of Washington, close to where I live in Seattle, and it's 1971. I mean, that's not very long ago. You know, for centuries, people were drinking alcohol. We were even giving alcohol intravenously to women to prevent preterm labor. So it's really been very recently that we've adopted this policy of zero tolerance, and it's because, you know, there's good reason to warn against alcohol because it can damage cells. We know this for a fact, right? There is damage that can be done. Two of the complicating factors are, one, we have no idea what a safe amount is, right? So for some women, that could be, you know, a glass of wine a night. So for some women, that could be four glasses of wine. It's individual. It probably has to do with metabolism, you know, genetics, that sort of thing. But we say we've created this blanket rule that really is a reflection more of public health policy than it is what the science says. And, you know, of course, I understand, especially for people, you know, most of us don't just get pregnant. It's not really, you know, it's not often an easy road. So we want to do everything we can to keep a fetus and a baby healthy. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, you know, I spoke to a doctor who specializes in addiction issues and who treats pregnant women with chemical dependencies and addiction issues. And he said, you know, there are studies that show people who have had fraternal twins where one of them is born with fetal alcohol syndrome and the other is not. So there's a certain level of prevention that you can do. And then there's also just sort of random luck. But we don't really like to have that conversation, or we sort of shy away from having that one.
We are still taking phone calls, 1-800-642-1234. Did you have a high-risk pregnancy? What happened with that? What were you told? Did you have preeclampsia, perhaps, or something else that put you in the hospital or on bed rest? Was this a surprise to you? And did you lose money because you couldn't work? 1-800-642-1234. Angela, one of the things that that you talk about in your book is the importance of a doula. I think most people don't really know what a doula is. Sure. It is something that I think if you have money and privilege, then you have access to this newfangled thing, which is really an old-fangled thing, called a doula. But talk to us about that.
Sure. So the origin of the word doula is, it's Greek and it means female servant. But I think, you know, that term has really evolved. And a doula is, I mean, basically that person is your support person who is there just for you. It's a non-medical role. So doulas might be really knowledgeable about childbirth, and they should be because they'll have attended births, but they're not nurses. You know, they're not going to try to step in and help with an IV, right? They are there to, they'll meet with you beforehand. They'll have an understanding of what's important to you. And if you're partnered up, they'll know what's important to you and your partner. And they're there to do things from putting a cold compress on your head to putting, you know, massaging your hips, or to help you ask questions of your care providers. And it's really, it's a role, and it's an important role. And I admire the people who take this on. There's formal trainings that you can do to do this now, but at its most basic, a doula is someone who's just got a mom's back. And in the book, I go into this, which is that, you know, as you were mentioning, you have to have a certain level of privilege and financial means to access a doula. But there's a study that's been done that for low-income women at a hospital, they informed them you can have someone, the technical phrase is continuous labor support. And they advised these women that if they wanted to, they could have someone present at their birth who would be their labor support person. And so these women picked a relative or a friend. And these women, the doulas, the lay doulas, let's say, received 4 hours of training. And the outcomes were better for all of these women when they gave birth. The labors were shorter, there were less interventions, and more importantly, the women had more positive memories, which I think is, if nothing else, like, that's what we should be focusing on, right? And so just having, turns out, having someone there who works just for you and is there to care for you has a tremendous impact on childbirth. And it's a very simple intervention. It's something so basic and human that we could provide for people that they should know about and that we should just talk about. And whatever sort of form your doula takes, we could really be helping women more. And that's why I think people should have access to that.
Women out there, you have about 10 seconds. Women out there who are pregnant for the first time, what is the one thing you want to tell them?
Oh, I would say that, you know, you're pregnant, but you were a person for a very long time before you became pregnant, you know, and I know that you are prioritizing the health of your baby and that fetus. And I would just say, though, that in all of that, not to lose sight of the fact that you are just as important as that fetus and as that baby. You're never any less important, and you deserve all the care in the world as well.
That was Angela Garbus. She wrote a book, Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy. Angela, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much, Carrie, for having me and for holding the space to have this conversation in the first place.
Thanks to all the callers who participated this morning, and thanks to you for listening. Coming up tomorrow at this time, colon cancers are increasingly occurring in younger people, and screening recommendations are changing too. It's The Morning Show.